Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, in Empowering Hour, we're going to talk about health and nutrition. We're going to explore how, at menopause, your fluctuating estrogen level increases sensitivity to stress and depression, University of North Carolina. How exercise, resistance exercise, where we really have to stress your body, is actually good for you during pregnancy, University of Gothenburg in Sweden. How gratitude heals disease, and how understanding the beneficial effects of green tea and apples can produce some really positive benefits in the body, and how rhodiola is important for anxiety and stress and mood disorders, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, suspended USDA scientist says the agency tried to block his research into the harmful effects of pesticides. Stephen Volk from Washington Post. Also, the death and extinction of bees from Joachim Hagopian. What does that mean? We'll talk about it. And a former pro-GMO scientist speaks out on the real dangers of genetically engineered foods. Also, how two-year-olds are now using mobile devices on a daily basis. And also, an increase in prescription drugs in the United States. New information about why the hepatitis B vaccine is bad, and Fukushima gets a lot uglier. Commentary today on how the myth of meritocracy ruins students by Erica Edelson from Truthout, and Tourists of Empire from William S. Store, America's peculiar brand of global imperialism. Also, time permitting, race baiting 101. And it's worth listening to because you'll see other races that were also used in the slave trade and a real good history of both races, people of color and Caucasians, used over the centuries. Our guest in the second part will be newsmaker guest near the end of the program, and there's a vaccine bill entering the New York State Legislature and Big Medicine's vaccine agenda. John Gilmore will be here to talk about what you can do to help challenge these bills coming up in New York State. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. There's a very important plant. It's called the rhodiola, R-H-O-D-A-I-O-L-A, rhodiola, rosea, R-O-S-E-A. This is from the University of Surrey in the United Kingdom. They're saying that it improves measures of mood in people with mild anxiety. And that's good. Quote, although rhodiola rosea has been used traditionally to relieve a range of symptoms of stress-related disorders, to our knowledge, this is the first study to demonstrate the efficacy of rhodiola in the treatment of mild anxiety. And this is from the chief researchers at the University of Surrey, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Phytotherapy Research. And that's good because it showed that these students who used it had a substantial improvement at 200 milligram doses, which is not a lot. So one more thing that can help people with anxiety and stress in a natural way that has no harmful side effects that can benefit you. This is the University of North Carolina, and it's a good study, and here's what it says. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause. If you're feeling a little blue during the transition to menopause, there's a good reason. According to this new study from the Department of Psychiatry, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, that the estradiol, that's a form of estrogen fluctuation that is common during the menopausal transition, may enhance emotional sensitivity to psychosocial stress. When combined with a very stressful life event, this sensitivity is likely to contribute to the development of a depressed mood. Okay. Now, it's generally accepted within the medical community that women are at greater risk to suffer from depression than men, and some study shows the risk is twice as great for women versus men to suffer major depression disorder. And it's been previously suggested that the greater risk is largely due to the depressive episodes that are tied to reproductive events, such as perinatal depression, premenopausal symptom, etc. This is showing it's different. And I believe this. This was a 12-month placebo-controlled randomized trial. And here's the bottom line. I'll give you the takeaway message. When you're in your 30s, if you have stressed yourself physiologically, if you have smoked or drank or taken drugs, if you have been sedentary, you haven't been active, if you have eaten a lot of inflammatory foods, if you have not responded to life stresses in a positive way, then there's almost a certainty that your body now is suffering premature aging, meaning that even though you may be 35 or 40, biologically, you're closer to 50 or 60, which then means that you can throw yourself into an estrogen imbalance earlier than what historically we would have thought, and then you go into perimenopause, premenopause, which sometimes is confusing because you can miss your periods. You can even go without a period. By the way, you could still get pregnant. There's a myth if you don't have your period that you cannot get pregnant in perimenopause. And what this is doing, it's causing an imbalance in the estrogen level, which then manifests in depression and hypersensitivity, meaning we're normally let something just, you know, let it go. Now, something said or done that normally wouldn't be a big deal becomes a big deal emotionally. And that's because you're in an estrogen imbalanced state. Now, there are three things that can cause an imbalance in your estrogen. One, a high-protein diet. Lots of meat in the diet. That's really bad for you. It's bad for you physically at the cellular level, but it's also bad because it imbalances estrogen hormones. Two, being overweight. When you're overweight, you have more body fat, hence more estrogen. That is going to cause a higher susceptibility to depression or anxiety. And three, normal aging, where you're no longer producing the same amount or same balance of hormones between estrogen and progesterone, and that can cause emotional sensitivity. So that's the problem. What is the solution? I did a one-year study of 287 women who completed the study. It was published. I presented it before a group of scientists, about 3,000 scientists. It was an important study because, to my knowledge, none has been done before or since that duplicates this. We were able to do the following to help women who were going through all this and a lot more: drying of the mucous membranes of the vagina, hair falling out, eyebrows thinning, skin getting rashes, urinary incontinence, inability to sleep through the night, lots of insomnia, mood swings, weight gain without overeating, fatigue, muscle cramps. So these were some of the symptoms. There were about 60 different symptoms that a person could have, any number of those. And you had to have those for at least a year to get into the study. Here's what changed all that. Here's the positive solutions. That which empowers. First and foremost, it was a very strict protocol. If you couldn't do it all, then you were excluded from the program. You had to do it all. You couldn't just do a little bit or a little piece. Everything. We were able to reverse virtually all the major problems of menopause and perimenopause and postmenopause by almost 94%, meaning women's hair grew back thicker, natural color, meaning women started to regain muscle strength. The human growth hormone kicked in, and suddenly where they had baggy, saggy, weak muscles and skin and folds of fat, now they had taut muscles. They had mental clarity, better cognition, sharper in their thought process. No more vaginal agitation and infections. They had full flushed vaginal lubrication so they could regain normal intimacy. they had lost a lot of weight, and the thyroid was rebalanced. Nails grew up pink and hard and shiny instead of dull and cracking and ridging and flaking. So we got rid of all animal proteins, a purely plant-based diet, exercising 5 days a week for an hour aerobically with strong resistance exercise 4 days a week for a half hour, not personalizing all stressors, going to a neutral place in your mind and looking at something more objectively, being able to let go of the past and be more present and conscious in the moment you're in, and also to detoxify, lots of juices, as many as 13 glasses of juice a day, lots of supplements, including Vitex, Dong Quai, Fo Tai, Passion Vine, Squall Vine, vitamin C, tocotrienols, vitamin D, D3, magnesium, calcium, resveratrol, grapeseed extract, all these wonderful nutrients. And it worked. It worked based upon good science, understanding of the human condition, and lifestyle and behavior modification. So they told you the problem. They're clueless on the solution. We're telling you the solution. Also, another good study that's just up from the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, it says, quote, swimming, walking, and other mild physical activities, along with avoidance of resistance exercise, are often recommended for pregnant women. But a new study found that resistance exercise can relieve symptoms related to pregnancy and improve sense of control. So they're suggesting suitable exercising and improving well-being through resistance exercise. Now, what do I mean by resistance exercise? I mean, let's say you've all seen, I'm sure, if you've gone to a gym, spinning classes, where they're just sitting there and they're, you know, biking and their feet are going a mile a minute. That's a junk exercise. It's functionally worthless. But if you turn the resistance so you really have to push those legs, you're resisting and you push, then you benefit. And it's the resistance exercises that are the great benefit. The rest of them are pretty much worthless. So resistance exercises. University of California, Berkeley, a good study showing that adults are now virtually, quote, an epidemic of ADHD. Quote, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is growing up. And it talks about the authors of this new work showing, quote, ADHD was never just for kids, and today many adults are getting the help they needed for years. And they're saying this. Well, my thoughts on that? Total, absolute nonsense. There is no such thing as ADHD in adults. In point of fact, most of that doesn't exist in children either. What does exist is a combination of factors, not limited to any one given area. It can be due to one area, electromagnetic stimulation, meaning cell phones. And as I have in a study here, it shows that children as young as 2 are now using cell phones as much as 2 hours a day, and that's a huge amount of electromagnetic stimulation. Listen to this. Quote, this is from the Daily Shepel, 77% of 2-year-olds now use mobile devices on a daily basis. Quote, there's no doubt that the pace of technological development we've seen in recent years has been both amazing and frightening. It certainly made our lives easier, but no one can ignore the fact that these developments are happening faster than the human race can adapt to them. Predictably, this has spawned a widespread fear of technology in our culture. These fears must be prolific. If they weren't, then Hollywood would have never made a fortune on movie franchises like The Terminator and The Matrix, and TV shows like Battlestar Galactica. Clearly, there are plenty of people in our society who are deeply afraid of the direction that modern technology is lurching towards. However, it goes on then to talk about, what about our children? In fact, when it comes to taking care of our children, the majority of the population is already outsourcing their child-rearing responsibilities to machines. We didn't notice this development because it didn't arrive in the way that pop culture prepared us for. rather than being brutally subjugated by robot overlords. We've been conquered by consumer electronics. Recently, a study was conducted of over 300 kids between the ages of 6 months and 4 years living in neighborhoods in Philadelphia. The study found that most parents now let their kids use mobile devices, often with the intent of keeping them preoccupied. With numbers like these, I'm sure that plenty of technophobes in our midst are among them. All right, so here's the takeaway message from that we have little kids using cell phones. The science of the cell phones, with more than 300 total studies plus, at least 44 of those studies show severe damage done, including increase in overheating of the chromosomes, high amount of agitation and inflammation in the brain, and an increased risk in the risk of cancers of the brain, the jaw, the head, the eye. All right, that's one. Then computer use. That's electromagnetic force. When you're up close to a computer, you're getting the electromagnetic pulse. That's dangerous. Also, we're using cell phones, computers, and every form of portable device. That's one type. Then that can overstimulate and cause imbalances in our emotions. Then we're not getting a good night's sleep. We're not getting the sleep we need. We're not getting deep sleep. Instead, we're waking up throughout the night. We're going to bed tired, too late, and then we have a hard time waking up in the morning. So what do? We take a caffeine fix. And depending upon our custom, the home environment, our peers, we might stop off and at a Starbucks and get a double hit of a cappuccino. We may make our own, take a cola and sugar. So sugar and caffeine are the artificial stimulants of energy that also causes adrenal exhaustion. And with adrenal exhaustion, the adrenal glands are now simply not able to keep up with putting out adrenaline to the level that we have been using it. So we end up with a form of low-level chronic fatigue. Then when we eat, we overeat. And when we overeat, we're almost always eating sugar or salt processed in a way that causes inflammation. And then the environment outside of the school or outside of the workplace is far more stimulating than that's in. As a result, we're trying to compare the environment in the schoolroom that the teacher is faced with that what a person wants to be in, and that is with their friends outside. So that creates an agitation, wanting to be someplace else. There's also a lot of stress each day and hyperactive movement. And as a result, one day you wake up and you're just not going to focus upon what you should be learning or how, in which case you're going to be falsely diagnosed with ADD or ADHD. Or you may have had vaccine injury, not enough to cause autism or Asperger's, but enough to cause the inability to focus consistently or the inability to retain information, so as a result, also diagnosed. Now, you grow up, and there are periods of time in your life where you're fine, and then other times when you're not, and you're bored out of your mind. And what do we do when we're bored? We look for distractions. We sublimate our boredom. And more often than not, we do so with things that are far more interesting, far more in-depth than our own day-to-day life. So, if you're able to see someone who is hyper, someone who's agitated, someone who cannot sit still, someone who's constantly doing things, multitasking, that's not because they have a brain chemical imbalance called attention deficit disorder or hypertension deficit disorder. It's because they have not balanced their life, their emotions, and their biochemistry. So instead of looking for a drug to treat them, why don't you look at the real cause, a society that is ungrounded? Also, this adds to this, because a lot of medications cause the very conditions they claim to be treating, like antidepressants can cause depression. Anti-anxiety causes anxiety. This is from Medical Express, and it's from Harvard. Quote, between 1999 and 2012, overall prescription drug use increased in the United States adults and substantially in all drug classes, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association, the current issue out today. The use of prescription drugs represents a major expenditure in the United States, and it's increasing. So, we're taking more drugs. And what kind of drugs are we taking? Well, the big group we're taking are anti-anxiety medications, which cause anxiety, and antidepressants, which cause depression. But we're also taking drugs for hypertension, diabetes, and other conditions as well, gastric reflux, and sleeping. So all that changes our biochemistry. And finally, can gratitude heal disease? This was a study published in the Science in Molecules and Emotions. Quote, for years, the only studies being done on the relationship between the emotions and physical health had to do with negative ones, such as anger, fear, and hopelessness. In recent years, however, there has been a flood of studies that have focused on the other side of the coin, how positive emotions, and especially feelings of gratitude, can have an effect upon the body and on physical health. The results of these studies point to a clear connection between the cultivation of positive emotional states and healing from and surviving major illness, including cancer. What research says about positive emotions? Quote, there were less than 24 studies scientifically done about the effects of gratitude on physical health coming into the second millennium. By 2011, there were 150. The surge has to do with developments in the fields of positive psychology and neuropsychoimmunology, and represents only a fraction of the research being conducted on the emotion-body connection today. Neuropsychoimmunologist and molecular biologist Candace Pert, Ph.D., explains how lignans and receptor sites in the brain work together through peptides to form specific physical responses to emotionally charged stimuli. Quote, the chain reaction of biochemical events is initiated as tiny machines roar into action, and as directed by the message of the lignin, begin any number of activities. Manufacturing new proteins, making decisions about cell division, opening or closing ion channels, adding or subtracting energetic chemical compounds, groups such as phosphates, to name just a few. In short, the life of the cell, what it is up to at any moment, is determined by which receptors are on its surface and whether those receptors are occupied by ligands, that's L-I-G-A-N-D-S, ligands, or not. On a more global scale, these minute physiological phenomena at the cellular level can translate to large changes in behavior, physical activity, even mood. So, that's at the brain level. But what motivates this are positive emotions, because positive emotions release dopamine and oxytocin, oxy, O-X-Y, tocin, T-O-C-I-N, which produce what social psychologist Barbara Fredrickson calls the broadening and build theory of positive emotions. With positive emotions, instead of narrowing thoughts and stiffening bodily reactions, there is a broadening and expanding on all levels. The mind opens to greater possibility. The immediate physical effects of this expansion include changes in breathing. You breathe easier, you breathe deeper. Your pulse comes down, and you balance out your hormones and blood pressure. So, every time you have a positive thought, and especially a positive thought where you're grateful, where you're showing gratitude, you are changing the body's response to the environment you're in. In effect, you're creating a healthier body, healthier biochemistry, healthier digestion, healthier mood, healthier hormones, healthier brain. Gratitude is an extraordinarily powerful emotion stimulator. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. And just a couple thoughts before we take a break. I believe that all of us are concerned about our educational institution. As a teacher, teaching at many different places over the years, currently at Fairleigh Dickinson University, but having been at Pratt Institute, School of the College New Rochelle, and others. There has to be a relationship between the teacher and the learner, where you ask a basic question: why are you in this class? What do you hope to gain from it? And create that type of sharing where what the student needs to be a learner, to apply that learning to real life circumstances you're there to provide. I don't believe any teacher is of value if all they're going in there is reciting what to take on a test so you can pass a test. And Erica Edelson agrees with that, but takes it even a step further. And I'd like for you to think about this for a moment. I'm going to if we have time later, I want to come back to this. It's the plight of the overscheduled, overtested, stressed out student. It's become the subject of much hand-wringing and several good educational policy prescriptions. But if youth are to escape the educational pressure cooker, we need to understand how the pervasive myth of the meritocracy traps them into it. And I believe, and I know many of you in this audience do, that a lot of the anxiety and depression, a lot of the angst, a lot of the disconnecting from reality that we see in a lot of the young people today is because they're not getting the tools they need in order to make proper choices. They frequently don't have the family input or the extended family input that historically we did have, the benefit of wise men and women, grandfathers, grandmothers, aunts, uncles, and parents. Today, a lot of what people are seeing are what the peers are giving them. And that's not a good place for a person to get the tools they need. But what if when they go into a classroom, you're there really to show you can take a test? Now, if you're rich, it's a way of proving that you deserve everything that's coming your way. And just imagine what percentage, not all, but what percentage of those who are wealthy never have to worry about failing, because there will always be someone there to pay for their losses. They're never having to learn a single lesson in life because someone else has said, don't worry about it, we'll get through this, which means they're going to make sure you don't have to pay for any of your lessons. And therefore, you feel this certain entitlement, maybe because you have parents who are in the 1% or the 3% or the 20%. And therefore, you're expected in life to be a bearer of that entitlement, where you live, what you wear, what you drive, the people you hang out with, the schools you attend are all a part of that. And then you have your working class or your poor. Imagine what it feels like to be a student who is going to be pressured into succeeding on a test to get into a school or even to graduate from high school, to have an exit exam that lets them get out with some certificate, where they feel they at least have some opportunity, because without that, there's no opportunity. But even with that, you still don't have the same opportunity, because we do not have equal among equals. We're always going to have a hierarchical structure among all that are supposed to be equal. As a result, all the kids at Harvard who have a 4-point average, who are valedictorians, who are present in their classes, who were straight A's, now they get to Harvard and realize that, but I came from a working class family to get here, and I gave up my childhood and hanging out with friends, knowing all the things I would otherwise do to get here. Now I see there are 4,000 other people who are 4-point average, but some have very wealthy families. Therefore, we're not equal. And then they get depressed. Could you imagine having a 4-point average at Harvard and being depressed and committing suicide? And that's exactly what has happened. Now imagine that you're not in the entitled group, but you're coming from a working class group. You're made to feel that life is a competition. You must compete against this because there's only so many chairs at the table. And if you don't get in one of those chairs, you're a loser. And therefore, just like when the Mets didn't win the World Series, it didn't matter how well they did to get there. It didn't matter they proved they were one of the two best teams in winning that year. They were considered losers. And I'm thinking, these people writing that they are losers, did you ever play the game? Were you ever an athlete? Did you ever suit up? Do you know what it's like when you've worked so hard and there's always going to be one person winning, one person not winning, that instead of congratulating the people who didn't win and say you did a good job, they condemn them? How do you think it makes them feel? That kind of competition. You're all cooking a good meal, but one of you is going to have to be fired because you didn't meet some subjective and completely arbitrary standard of a bunch of losers themselves who pretend that they should be judges. All of these reality shows have a bunch of, in my opinion, misanthropic, extraordinarily spiritually stunted people being in judgment of other people and say, you're not good enough, goodbye. Suddenly making a person feel that competition is the only quality that means anything, and hence survival of the fittest. I must beat the competition. I must be better than everyone else. Why can't you cooperate? Why is it against the rules to be cooperative in life? Why can't we do the we instead of me? Why can't we share and harmonize our energies together for a common good? Why must be a neighborhood where everyone looks out the window at the family that's having their home foreclosed on, and the sheriffs take away their possessions and put out in the front yard, yet they don't have a big enough truck or the money to rent one, and yet you're not walking out there saying, friend, we've been neighbors for 20 years. We lived across the street from each other. Let me help you with some of that. Let me help lessen your burden today. We don't do that in America because we've been conditioned to believe that the only thing that matters is winning at whatever we do. And we then maladapt to the lowest common denominator of winning. And that's why we have kids that today are so confused and unfortunately so maladapted. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to be sharing insights on a USDA scientist telling us about how they tried to stop him from talking about the dangers of pesticides, why we should pay attention to the bee colonies out there, how a former pro-GMO scientist is now anti-GMOs, and how a hepatitis B exposure trains newborns' immune cells, enhancing their ability to respond to pathogens, and all this plus a guest on at the end of the program on vaccine bills in New York State. But before then, just want to take a moment to tell you that based upon a woman stopping me on the street yesterday, and she's a senior citizen, she's 82 years of age, and she said that she comes from Brooklyn up to 89th and Broadway to my health food store, because she loves the produce, she loves the staff, she talks with Neil, and she says that she wanted to get some survival stuff, but she just didn't have the money. And she said, but I see that you've got everything in there I need. And I said, okay, I'm going to make a special for you and anyone else for the next 48 hours only that I've never done before. Here it is. For my unique product, which is almost a gallon, it's 1,800 grams, that is non-GMO, it's vegan, it has the pea protein, the brown rice protein, for the best quality plant-based amino acids, it's got alfalfa and pumpkin seeds, flax seeds, barley grass, carrots and kale, cauliflower and cabbage, parsley and ginger, spinach and celery, broccoli and asparagus and collard greens, apples, bananas, cranberries, strawberries, chlorella, spirulina, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, kamuts, juice, oats, rice bran, sprouted quinoa, sprouted kamuts, sprouted spelt, sprouted amaranth, oat beta-glucan, chia seeds, alaria, the seaweed, dulse, the seaweed, laminaria, the seaweed, Ascophyllum, the seaweed, the fructooligosaccharides, the probiotics, 8 billion, enzymes such as protease, amylase, lipase, cellulase, papain, and bromelain, all of these in a delicious, natural pineapple and cherry flavor. It's called Survival Stuff, 17 grams of complete vegetable protein, huge amount of fiber, 15 grams of fiber, and it is terrific. So for you can thank Nelly, 82 years of age. It's normally, normally 360. We had it on special for 230. As of the next 48 hours, Survival Stuff, until supplies last, $159.95. There, you heard me right, and this is Survival Stuff. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 for 48 hours to help her and all the other people who may be financially stressed, way down in price. Huge savings, huge, over the normal retail price of what is undoubtedly the most powerful, important, all-inclusive nutritional powder supplement that I know of in the world. There's just nothing that's in the same universe compared to what you're getting in this bottle. All right? So there it is. It's normally $340. We had discounted it down to $229.95 to help people, but for 48 hours, $159.95. That's it, or until supplies last on this shipment. 877-627-5065. Nice to have you with us, everyone. This is what a suspended USDA scientist says. This is from Stephen Volk from the Washington Post. Quote, a prominent Agricultural Department scientist is alleging that he was suspended after complaining that the agency was blocking his research into the harmful effects of pesticides on pollinators such as bees and butterflies. In a whistleblower complaint filed yesterday, Jonathan Lundgren, an entomologist and 11-year veteran of the USDA's Agriculture Research Services, says his supervisors retaliated against him by suspending him initially for 30 days before reducing it to 14 days. The complaint filed with the Federal Merit System Protection Board says his supervisor began, quote, to impede or deter his research and resultant publications more than a year ago. And he also alleges that the agency tried to prevent him from speaking out about his findings for political reasons and interfered with his ability to review the research of other scientists. So, here's an honest public official. That's rare. Seeing the truth that pesticides and the neonicotinoids and specifically are killing bees, that's a fact, and wanting to tell the American public about it, he should. And suddenly this president specifically and his administration have been completely 100% pro-GMO, pro-big agra, pro-pesticides, pro-artificial fertilizers, and hence the consequences of the enormous bee colony collapse. One half of all beehives last year in the United States, commercial beehives, dead. And why is that important? Because this president, personally, and the sycophants around him, all very brilliant technocrats using their powers of persuasion for special interest groups, which is good, I guess, if you're one of the special interest groups, but not if you're an average person or an average farmer, an average citizen, because he uses the Espionage Act as a weapon to keep honest workers from telling the truth about corrupt politicians. Now, why that seems so difficult for the average person to wrap their brain around, especially, well, I understand why the people at Fox News Network can't understand that. But then again, I don't understand how that network could ever exist in the real world with the stupidity I hear on it. But if you have someone who is honest and they've found out that an agency is doing something illegal, immoral, unethical, wouldn't it seem that we would want to know that information? And knowing that the people in power are never going to share it with us, so if someone risks their career to come forward and tell the truth, shouldn't they be appreciated instead of vilified? And the answer is it depends upon your ideological leanings. If you're a fascist, then you don't want the truth to ever come out except for the manufactured truth that you share, propaganda. I'm going to cite just a few words here from this study that was published at Global Research from a Hagopian. Quote, scientists have recently reported that mass extinctions of marine animals may soon be occurring at alarmingly rapid rates that previously projected due to pollution, rising water temperatures, and loss of habitat. Many land species also face a similar fate for the same reasons, but perhaps the biggest foreboding danger of all facing humans is the loss of global honeybee populations. The consequence of a dying bee population impacts man at the highest levels on our food chain, posing an enormously grave threat to human survival. Since no one single animal species plays a more significant role in producing the fruits and vegetables that we humans commonly take for granted, yet require nearly a daily usage in order to stay alive. The greatest modern scientist, Albert Einstein, once prophetically remarked, quote, mankind will not survive the honeybee's disappearance for more than 5 years. Since 2006, beekeepers have been noticing that honeybee populations have been dying off at increasingly rapid rates. Subsequently, researchers have been scrambling to come up with an accurate explanation and an effective strategy to save the bees and, in turn, save some Homo sapiens from extinction. Recent harsh winters that stay freezing cold well into spring have been instrumental in decimating the honeybee population in Iowa by up to 70%. As well as the other historically high-yielding honey states, Dakotas, Montana, Minnesota, the northern plains and midwestern states that have regionally always produced the nation's most honey have been severely hurt by the long, harsh winters in the last couple of years. Florida, as the third largest honey producer, and especially California, always among the top producers, have been hit especially hard by decreasing bee colony populations. In 2006, when the problem of bee loss first was noticed, California was right at the top, with North Dakota producing nearly twice as much honey as the next state, South Dakota. But its bee numbers have incurred such heavy losses that California's honey production fell by 50% in just 6 years. The recent severe drought in California has become an additional factor, driving both its honey yield and bee numbers down, as less rain means less flowers available to pollinate. Honeybee colony collapse disorder, as this loss of bee phenomena has been called, is currently recognized as such an urgent crisis that a month ago in Newsweek, I ran an article outlining the U.S. Department of Agriculture's announcement that it will provide $3 million subsidy in order to help the one animal on the planet that will either make or break food prices. According to the latest USDA industry survey, this emergency plan assistance comes after nearly a third of commercial honeybees died last winter, a whopping increase of 42% from the previous year. The $3 million giveaway program is designed to entice both Midwest dairy farmers and cattle ranchers to reseed their fields this spring with eco-friendly crops like alfalfa and clover to develop healthier habitats for increasing the nation's bee population. Farmers and ranchers only had until March 21st to sign up, take advantage of the seedling. Well, what's it mean? Here's what it means. Quote, last month's Newsweek reported honeybees and trucks migrate to various regions of the country to pollinate an estimated $40 billion worth of the nation's agriculture produce each year. This means that every third bite of food we eat comes as a result of bees and other pollinators. USDA's Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack stated that more than 130 fruits and vegetables that make up a nutritious diet are cross-pollinated by honeybees. Commercial bee raisers then ship these bees to other farms for pollinating, and that's how it's done. In the last half decade, 30% of the nation's bee population has disappeared, and nearly a third of all bee colonies in the U.S. have perished. that the rate of bee population is growing each year, 42% more than last year and the year before. Okay, my thoughts on this? I'm a beekeeper. I've been raising bees for decades. The most hives I've ever had was 144 hives. First, we should not be taking their honey. Save the honey for the bee. Leave it in the cones. Secondly, build barriers around those hives to break the severe winter winds. And that way they have something to eat and they're not freezing to death. Also, we should be colonizing hives in California, in places, and not transporting them. When they're transported, they're not fed. They're subject to the harsh winters, and they have no coat. They have no fur. They have no down. They have nothing to protect them. So what happens is the bees make a mass around the queen, and overnight, those that were on the outside freeze to death and are discarded. And the next night, those who are on the outside that freeze to death, and they'll finally end up decimating thousands and thousands of bees with one trip. You shouldn't be transporting bees at all. Now, my bees are thriving. This winter in Florida, I will put out every morning a plate, and I will put about 2 cups of their own raw, organic, unfiltered, unheated honey for them as food, because there'll be times, weeks at a time, when there's nothing they can pollinate. And they have to wait till spring. So they have to eat. So you're giving the food that they have made for themselves, just giving it back to them. And that way they don't die off in a rapid way. Also, there's no spraying of any of the neonicotinoids, the pesticides. Because when you stress them, you don't feed them, and then you weaken their immune system, then you give them pesticide sprays, there should be no surprise about colony collapse. What the USDA should do and won't, because it's utterly in the control of big agra, is they should take the time to invite those of us who are successful organic farmers and beekeepers to share our experience, decades, individually and collectively, and see how it's done right. Because we do it right, and they don't. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Let's go out to Long Beach, New York, and say hello to John Gilmore and also Rita Palma. John is the executive director of Autism Action Network, a national nonprofit grassroots advocacy organization that influences legislation and public policy on a wide range of issues impacting the autism community, including access to health care and health insurance reform. And he has degrees in public policy from the Graduate School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. And he lives in Long Beach with his wife and 2 teenage sons, one who was vaccine injured as an infant and diagnosed with autism. And he is also has the website autismactionnetwork.org. And then Rita Palma is a parent advocate for vaccine exemptions and a founder of My Kids, My Choice, which assists parents to navigate New York State's immunization exemption laws and to oppose vaccine mandates. Rita is very familiar with the obstacles and frustrations in going through religious waiver to immunization in New York State, even though such waivers remain legal in the state. She has 3 children and has gone up against the corruption of the state and the educational systems regarding vaccine. Her website is mykidsmychoice.com. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay, John, we're going to start with you.
Okay. We
have now seen California Governor Jerry Brown signing the vaccine bill SB 277 into law, which removes all vaccine exemptions except for medical indications for school entry. And there
That's
are
right.
further regressive, tyrannical bills in California's assembly that will further erode medical freedom of choice. And as campaign donations of either of the people come in, meaning in California, we start to see them aligning their votes with who's giving them the money. And we see big pharma and the vaccine manufacturers giving money to the very people, then turn around and say, oh, I'm doing this for the parents' good and the children's good. And I'm having to say, how can we possibly believe that when the money you're receiving are from the vaccine companies who are their vaccines are part of what you're mandating the child must get? Your thoughts?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head that SB 277 was the largest in, for the vaccine industry, the most successful of many, many attempts this year to try and weaken vaccine choice rights, not only across the United States, but this has become a global issue. Attempts to weaken vaccine rights were also launched in Canada, Australia, Ireland, the UK, and Israel, and maybe other places I'm not even aware of. So we're really talking about a global political movement here, and it's completely funded by the vaccine industry. Vaccines, contrary to what we're told, over the last 20 years have emerged as a very, very big money maker for the drug industry. It's almost a perfect product in a way. You have the government order people to use your product. You can basically set your own price, and if anything goes wrong with the product, you have complete liability immunity. You cannot, at least in the United States, you cannot sue a vaccine manufacturer or anybody who administers the vaccine if there's an injury involved. So this is what we're up against, not only in New York and across the United States, but around the world at this point.
It was reported last month that the Supreme Court supported the Second Circuit's decision to refuse to hear challenges in opposition to these vaccine bills. And this decision was applauded by New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. What are your thoughts on this?
Fortunately, that the lower court's decision doesn't really do that much damage. Basically, what it said is that the existing law in New York is constitutional. So it didn't really move the ball forward for us at all, but at the same time, it didn't really move it back either. So there's differences of opinions about this, but I think basically that one was a wash. So and given the Supreme Court, some of the absolutely horrendous decisions they've made in the last few years, we potentially could have dodged a bullet with that one.
Okay, Rita, if these bills pass New York State, religious exemption is removed, what are your next suggestions to parents who refuse to vaccinate their children regarding their continuing education?
Well, you know, right now we're so busy fighting the bills,
yes.
And with a decent measure of success, that I don't even want to look past that. You know, the reality of having the religious waiver taken away from us is horrifying to me. I don't know what parents would do. I don't know how they would educate their children, because the parents that I deal with will not be coerced or blackmailed into having their children vaccinated. So the reality it's turning out to be, these bills were introduced a few months ago, and they're kind of presenting a good opportunity to get parents activated and out to their legislators so they voice their views to the very people that make the laws, and they persuade them in groups and, you know, with family and friends to not support these bills. And so far, we've met with success. We haven't really run into any lawmakers that are going to be actively supporting it. Many are actively opposing it. We still have a long ways to go in the legislature. There's 213 people to get to. We hope to get to them all by the end of the session for January. So far, so good. So we're making good points with our legislators. They the majority of them do seem to support the Constitution and First Amendment freedoms, which is handy. So we're on a good path. Parents are activated. Parents are motivated to hold on to their waivers and to hold on to their right to control what goes into their children's bodies. Even parents who vaccinate don't want the ability to make medical choices for their children taken away from them, because we all sat and watched what happened in California, and we don't want that happening in New York.
Then in California, it's well known now that the bill's sponsor, pediatrician Dr. Richard Pan, is a rabid pro-vaccine advocate who has received more upfront and hush monies from pharmaceutical firms than any other state senator in California history. What do we know about Dinowitz and Hoylman's background and connection to Big Pharma? And do we know of any financial ties or campaign donations either of these men have received, or is their past legal careers a problem? Tell us what you know.
Well, I'll take a first stab at that, Gary. Both of them have received, from the public records we have seen, relatively small donations from drug companies that we know of. Right? We've got two things here that we're sort of dealing with. One is just plain old corruption, and we saw that in California, is that just an unbelievably huge amount of money was dumped into Sacramento by the vaccine industry to get 277 passed. In New York, that hasn't happened yet, right? And we're quite concerned that, you know, that may happen at some point, which is why we're ferociously organizing in the state. Another thing we deal with is this sort of, you know, this sort of a knee-jerk belief that we see amongst a lot of people and legislators as well, that vaccines are always good and that they never do any harm and that nothing could ever go wrong in this process, right? That's the second thing that we have to deal with. And sometimes it's hard to tease out which is which. Now, another issue that we run into is that there is a lot of money being given by drug companies in New York to the legislature. However, what seems to be going on is that the money doesn't seem to percolate down. It goes into the few hands of the people at the top who kind of keep most of it, right? Consequently, there's a lot of rank-and-file legislators who really haven't been subjected to just the massive quantities of monies that we saw being thrown around in California.
You know, John, there's another way of looking at what you just said. What you're saying is that not enough money has been handed down to the legislators to show that they should viably corrupt themselves because they didn't get enough to justify leaning on the issue on the side of the pharmaceutical industry. That doesn't tell us a lot about the integrity of the legislators.
No, it doesn't, but I think you kind of have I think that's an accurate assessment of what's going on. But it does give us, not only in New York, but some other states where the sort of same thing goes on, that gives us a chance to actually influence the outcome of things. You know, it's just not axiomatic that Big Pharma is going to win, because they won in California, but they tried to do the same thing in about 17 other states. And they basically lost everywhere else except in California. They got a little bit of what they wanted in some of the states.
That should not surprise you. It's California. If you've ever lived in California, been to California, I had a radio show 6 hours every week. It's surprising. It's surprising that it took them that much effort to pass it in California. In any case, New York's a different ballgame altogether. In population New York, 64% of all three-year-olds have not been being fully vaccinated,
right.
And that so New York is not the same as California or some other states. Final thoughts: what can we do, and what about State Senator Martin Dillon, who would permit philosophical exemption in a bill that he's sponsoring?
Senator Martin Malavé-Dillon introduced a bill earlier in the session that would have given us a philosophical exemption in New York. However, when the whole measles PR campaign started in California and went nationwide, the pushback on legislators like DeLon was huge. You literally had the New York Times calling him and the other supporters of the bills baby killers, right? And if you are a Democratic Party politician in New York City and you have the New York Times calling you baby killer, you better stop what you're doing. And that's exactly what happened.
Now, he's a good corporate Democrat. The New York Times sponsors corporate Democrats.
Well,
we all know that, right?
You're absolutely right. And
okay,
so,
if people want the truth and they want to help the cause,
right?
Can they go to AutismActionNetwork.org?
Absolutely. You can sign up for our mailing list. We have action alerts right on the homepage. All you got to do is click on it, and that will allow you to send email messages to your legislators in New York. And it also allows you to get into on our mailing list so we can keep you informed of what's going on. We are organizing sessions all over the state right now. We have them going on in Long Island and Staten Island, up in the Adirondacks, Albany, Buffalo, all over the place. We're meeting with grassroots people and mobilizing them to lean hard on their...
John, good. We're out of time. And Rita
okay.
Palma, your site is mykidsmychoice.com. Have either one of you given out or watched Silent Epidemic, my newest documentary on vaccine safety and efficacy?
I have not, but I'm looking forward to seeing it.
And I've given out copies of it, and I don't have any more. So
okay,
we will
send both of you 100 copies today.
That'd be great.
Because
that answers
the question. It's a very simple question. Are vaccines safe? Or are they effective? What is the evidence? And we take on this issue with leading board-certified people in toxicology, immunology, and vaccinology, and they answer the question. And that will help a lot of parents get behind the movement to protect their children and their rights. Thank you both very much, John Gilmore and Rita Palma, for being out there and supporting parents' rights.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.